Oh yeah. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas and this honorable court.
Thank you. Be seated. This morning, there are three oral arguments on our oral submission docket. In the order of their presentation, they are Stephen Earle versus Michael and Shirley Ratliff from Bexar County, Southwestern Refining Company Incorporated and others versus Julia Bernal and others from Nueces County, and Martin Villarreal versus San Antonio Truck and Equipment and Robert Gonzalez from Bexar County. In each matter, the court has allotted 20 minutes for each side to present oral argument. The petitioner may reserve a portion of that time for rebuttal by advising the marshal of the court. We are making an oral tape of these arguments, and you may purchase a copy of that tape for a nominal fee from the clerk of our court. We will take a brief recess in between the presentation of each argument and conclude the arguments by lunch. Court is ready to hear argument from petitioner in Earle versus Ratliff.
May it please the court, Ms. Phyllis Speedlin will present argument for the petitioner. Petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal. Good morning, and may it please the court. With the court's indulgence, I'd like just to take a moment and mention my senior partner who has traveled from San Antonio with me, Mr. George Spencer. If I had any sense, I would be allowing Mr. Spencer to argue this before you today. He's been a practicing attorney in the state of Texas for 51 years, and he was the primary author of the brief before you, and I believe his astuteness in being able to look at legal issues is surpassed by none. I have to also say that he has been my senior partner and mentor for 16 years, and I'm more nervous about arguing in front of him than I am before this esteemed body. The issues before this court, we believe, are simple. This was a summary judgment granted on behalf of Dr. Stephen Earle by Judge David Peoples in Bexar County on two bases. One, that the 1991 surgery was barred by limitations, and on the second basis primarily, and that is that as to the 1993 surgery, Dr. Earle submitted summary judgment proof sufficient to establish that he had met the standard of care. The Fourth Court of Appeals reversed that opinion, and we, of course, are before you to argue that that was an error.
There seems to be some confusion about how many surgeries there were.
And let me try to explain that. The Fourth Court of Appeals actually did a pretty good job of explaining that. There were three surgeries referenced at times. The second surgery, however, was a nominal surgery to remove a device used to stimulate bone growth. It is not an issue in this case. There is no claims of negligence as to the second surgery. The two surgeries in issue was the 1991 surgery, or the first surgery, and the 1993 surgery, which in some ways accounting would be the third surgery. At the time this case was decided, we had, we believed, a case directly on point. This was a case decided by Judge Baker, Shook versus Herman, out of the Dallas Court of Appeals. In that case, very similar to this case, we had a situation of two surgeries. They were involving eye surgeries over a period of several years. The plaintiffs in that case, as in the Earle case, argued that what you had was a series of events, or a chain of events, I think was what they argued, that made it a course of treatment and therefore invoked the second of the three scenarios under Article 4590I.
Can surgery ever be part of a course of treatment, or must surgery always be treated as a separate event under the first prong of the limitations rule in 4590I?
I believe, Your Honor, that that would be based upon the facts and the allegations as presented in each particular lawsuit.
So regardless of Shook and other cases that have focused on the date of surgery as triggering limitations under 4590I, there are cases in which surgery could be part of a course of treatment so that the last date of treatment would in fact be the triggering date?
If, Your Honor, I believe that is correct, if the surgery was not the focus and the cause of the patient's damages. If, however, the surgery was being argued as a cause of the patient's damages, as to that entity, that particular cause of action, that personal injury, legal injury. I would believe that for that surgery, that would be a precise date.
If we are unable to distinguish, however, to what extent the injury is attributable to the surgery itself, and to what extent the follow-up treatment continues to aggravate or compound the injury because of some deficit in the treatment during that period of time following surgery, then would that be a case where course of treatment would be the triggering date, the end of treatment would be the triggering date?
Certainly you could probably create a factual scenario where in fact the precise date could not be ascertained from the facts. The scenario that you are giving would come close to that, where it is the damages are so intermingled you could not distinguish between whether the surgery caused the damages or the postoperative care caused the damages.
For example, if the surgery caused some sort of an injury and then during the post-surgery treatment period, perhaps there were things that the surgeon could have done to mitigate or ameliorate the problem, and in fact the problem was compounded, got worse, whatever along the way. Even if the surgery began this unfortunate chain of events, could that conceivably be a course of treatment limitations case?
Again, I think it's based on every factual scenario. I would caution the court, however, because obviously if it has an ascertainable date that controls, and that was more clearly established by this very court in the Hussein case, which was decided after the Earl case was decided by the Fourth Court of Appeals. In Hussein, if you note, although that is not a surgical case, that is a medical case involving the diagnosis of breast cancer or the delay in diagnosis of breast cancer, you can't determine when she actually was damaged in that case. Yet this honorable court said that you can determine when each time the doctor saw her, so you can ascertain a specific date. And for actions related to that date, limitations run from that date. So going back to your question, for damages created by surgery, no matter what postoperative care might have done to exacerbate it, I think you have an ascertainable injury with the date of surgery, and then as to that date of surgery, as to those injuries, limitations would run.
Well, let's say a doctor leaves a sponge in a patient during surgery. We know that injury occurred as of the date of the surgery, and the patient continues to go back to the doctor for follow-up, goes in every couple of weeks, every month, whatever, complaining of fever and pain and problems along the way. And the doctor fails to diagnose at each instance that that sponge is there and that there's something that could be done to take care of the problem. Would that involve a course of treatment? Is that an injury that occurs every time the doctor has the opportunity to fix the problem and doesn't?
Yes, I think it is an injury that occurs. If you've got, in fact, this court has decided that, I will bring to the attention of the court what case that is, but you have already decided that in a Supreme Court case, where the evidence in a summary judgment context was the doctor who was following the patient had a duty on every visit to, in fact, it was a breast cancer case, to do a mammogram or to do a check on that patient. That court, although the opinion is difficult to read, is really saying we have an ascertainable date each time the doctor saw the patient. Each time the doctor saw the patient that he had a duty to examine, didn't examine, and therefore her breast cancer went undiagnosed, there was an ascertainable date, a cause of action arose, she had 2 years and arguably 75 days to bring a lawsuit from that day.
From the end of the course of treatment?
No, from each instance. From each instance.
How under those circumstances would you then determine which damages flowed from which visit?
That's an excellent question, and one I also felt and believed in the Hussein case that, again, you couldn't determine in the Hussein case what damages flowed from what visit because the issue of cancer was not diagnosed until later.
And isn't that why course of treatment is in the limitations period to take care of those kinds of circumstances?
No, I believe, Your Honor, with all due respect, it isn't. Citing the court to, the case I want to reference. Going back to Hussein, I believe, again, the court has said it is unimportant whether you characterize it as a failure to diagnose or an improper course of treatment. The issue is, under the facts, can you have an ascertainable date of injury, and whether the facts and circumstances of such are enough to put the plaintiff on notice that there might be an injury. Not that he has to know fully what his damages are. A Supreme Court case, again, I apologize, I'm blanking on the Jennings case. It's the Jennings case where, again, the woman did not know she had cancer, yet this court said that it was a negligent referral before she had an opportunity to know what her damages were. That was the ascertainable date that then limitations ran from. And I do not believe that, I believe, like the Hussein case is, that the reason you have the second and third prongs under Article 4590I is as a proxy. In such a situation, the statute resolved doubt about the time of accrual in plaintiff's favor by using the last date of treatment or hospitalization as a proxy for the actual date of the tort. A perfect example of when this would apply is currently we are dealing, the media is dealing, especially maybe not this court yet, with these diet drug cases where women are bringing, men and women are bringing lawsuits where they claim they have been injured for taking diet drugs over a period of 20 months, for example. You cannot determine when in the 20 months there may have been an actual injury. If only at the end of the course of treatment have they been able to say, yes, we now have heart valve problems. That would be a perfect example where you would use as a proxy the last date of treatment to establish the breach of or tort.
Well, in this case, based on what you've told us,
yes, sir.
How come Dr. Mooney's affidavit doesn't raise a fact question on whether or not the second operation was an independent ground of negligence, given everything you've told us as to how you think the law is
okay, now that's on the issue of whether we came forward with enough proof to establish that we had met the standard of care and whether Dr. Mooney controverted that adequately
exactly.
with his affidavit. We filed, as the court I'm sure notes, objections to Dr. Mooney's affidavit in several respects. We presented that to Judge Peoples. One of the paragraphs that was struck was the only paragraph that Dr. Mooney discussed with the 1993 surgery, and that is in the transcript at page 302, and the court, Judge Peoples, found that that paragraph was conclusory because Dr. Mooney stated that merely the surgery on Mr. Ratliff was medically unwarranted without stating what the basis of that opinion was or what specifically the standard of care was that made that medically unwarranted. Judge Peoples struck that as conclusory and therefore not proper summary judgment evidence. Does that answer your question, Judge?
Ms. Phelan, it seems that one of the issues, let me ask you. There is negligence in the first surgery. Maybe the surgery shouldn't have been done.
Yes, sir.
As you come along and you have a second surgery, arguably, because the first surgery didn't do what it was supposed to do,
right.
You now have to have the second surgery.
Right.
There are no negligence. The second surgery is medically indicated in all reasonable medical probability. You're supposed to have the surgery. The surgery was all conducted according to the standards in the medical profession. Is that second surgery an injury?
It depends, again, on the pleadings and the proof before the court at the time.
No, just assume there was nothing that beginning with a negligently performed first surgery, now we take the patient as we find the patient, and everything after that is all medically required, medically necessary, properly done, this other surgery. That surgery occurs. Is that surgery an injury?
No, I would say argue it was not, and I would agree in this particular case, judgment or Dr. Mooney agreed with us because in his affidavit he said, but for the original surgery, nothing else would have been necessary.
So if a doctor commits the negligence, and we have an ascertainable date, and 4590I says statute of limitations begins to run from that date, then it is in the patient's best interest not to permit that doctor to attempt to correct the errors but it's in that patient's best interest to find another doctor with additional medical expenses and have that doctor attempt to correct the error so that they can now have an adversarial relationship with the first doctor.
Well, obviously, I would not argue that. And in this particular
but
case,
isn't
I
that
would
the
not...
result, isn't that the result of this case by saying that if we don't count the subsequent medical invasion here as a continuation of the negligence, but simply say negligence is a discrete event that occurred at the first surgery and everything after that, you still have to measure against this standard, and if that's not breached, then you've got to sue the very doctor who's now attempting to correct the problem that was created by the first surgery.
I do believe that our law does put the patient on notice when, during the course of 2 years, in that 2 years, it becomes obvious that the first surgery did not fully correct his problems. It does put him on notice for further inquiry as to what is going on and whether he, in fact, does have a cause of action against his primary physician.
Not notice for further inquiry, notice to sue.
Well, inquiry to find, I would say, or inquiry to find out if there was something done wrong, if, in fact, there was an error in the first procedure.
But what if the patient is doing the further inquiry, but doing it with the doctor?
Well, in this particular case, note that there was further inquiry. Mr. Ratliff had two second opinions between the first and the second surgery, and in fact saw a different physician who concurred in the need for a second surgery. I don't know if that answers your question.
Counsel, you, in response to Chief Justice Phillips' questions, when you were referring to the paragraph that you came to claim as conclusory in Dr. Minnie's affidavit, the third page of the affidavit does have a paragraph on the general, on the standard of care, in which it lists
right.
what the standard of care requires for the reasonably prudent surgeon treating a person with a back injury. The next paragraph says, in my opinion, the following acts and things that occurred were, in fact, breaches of the standard of care or negligence. Then there's a list that says 1, 2, 3, 4, and 4 is one of those. So standard of care is in this affidavit. It's on page 3 of the affidavit, isn't it?
No, Your Honor.
Okay,
if you read the general standard of care set up in that first paragraph on page 3, you will see that he is referencing the standard of care for an initial back surgery. He is not referencing standard of care for a patient who has previously had back surgery, now has spinal instability, and is having continual pain and needs to have something done to relieve that continual pain. In fact, what you see is reference to the 1991 surgery just by the essence of what he is talking about. Although I agree, Your Honor, he doesn't specifically say this only applies to the 91 surgery.
And you'd agree that this affidavit, because we're dealing with a summary judgment, is really the non-movement gets the benefit of the doubt, in other words, in terms of looking at this affidavit.
Yes, Your Honor, I do agree that the standards do require the movement to get the benefit of the doubt.
Okay. Let me ask you one more question. With respect to the informed consent claims, were these list procedures?
Yes, Your Honor, these were list procedures, and the summary judgment evidence established that the form as required by the Texas Disclosure Panel was in fact signed by the patient, and therefore a rebuttable presumption was created that all of the procedures had been met. Now, the informed consent as to the 91 surgery, we would say was also barred by limitation. Thank you, Your Honor.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. Court is ready to hear argument from respondents.
May it please the court, Ms. Donna Bowen will present argument for the respondents.
Good morning. This is an important case to my clients, not only to the Ratliffs, but to the five other families that we represent that have lawsuits against Dr. Earl for this very same scenario. Taking a patient with an on-the-job back injury that's covered by workers' comp, and early on in that treatment, performing extensive back surgery that's not warranted by any of the objective tests that have been done, inserting metal bone plates and screws into the backs of those patients without ever telling them of the risk and the complications specific to the use of those devices in the spine, and then knowingly misrepresenting to those patients that the cause of their debilitating problems is the unnecessary surgery that he performed. Mike Ratliff was first operated on by Dr. Earl in 1991, at which time he performed a 3-level fusion and a 4-level nerve decompression of the lumbar spine. This was 5 months after his on-the-job injury. Mr. Ratliff's condition continued to deteriorate after that, and in 1993, Dr. Earl performed a second surgery, which he took out those pedicle devices and inserted new pedicle devices into his spine.
You agree that the intervening surgery was unimportant?
I do agree, Your Honor. It was a bone stimulator that has to be taken out at a certain point. Now, I will say, if he hadn't done the first unnecessary surgery, we wouldn't have had it.
Also, petitioner says that there is no pleading or claim of negligence or injury on your part in the interim period, in the arising out of the treatment between the surgeries. Do you agree with that?
I don't agree with that, Your Honor. What we have here, we have an unnecessary first surgery. We have a doctor with actual knowledge of an unnecessary first surgery. That meant that the entire course of treatment for this particular problem was unnecessary. When you have it, I mean, an unnecessary surgery is
negligent.
But
is there anything independent in the intervening care between the two surgeons? Any claim that, I don't know, that medication was given or not given when it should have been or shouldn't have been or anything like that? I understand your position that the first surgery caused everything that happened thereafter. But then was there any independent, if your claim as to the first surgery is barred by limitations, is there an independent claim as to the care following the first surgery?
Yes, Your Honor. In Texas, a physician has a continuing duty to disclose to his patient material facts that are affecting his condition. He also has a continuing duty to disclose to his patient the reason for his suffering throughout the course of treatment.
What may I ask then, the failure to disclose, if I understand your argument, is that the original surgery was unnecessary.
The failure to disclose is that the original surgery was unnecessary and that is why he continued in the pain that he was in. He never told him, here's why you're having
problems. Should we also say that all the pain that your client suffered resulted from the initial surgery and not from each visit that he may or may not have had with Dr. Earl between the first and last surgery?
Well, Your Honor, Mr. Ratliff's condition was deteriorating. And Dr. Earl continually told him, this is normal, this is to be expected, you're going to be big and strong, I'm going to make
you
95% better.
That goes to your argument that you believe Dr. Earl concealed the fact of the unnecessary surgery and said those things as a cover-up, and that's your argument. And so I still don't see that you've answered Justice Heck's question. What exactly was negligent treatment between the first and final surgery that you allege would be a continuing course of treatment?
All right, and I guess my position is I can't put course of treatment here and fraudulent concealment here and even open courts here. To me, we've got the whole thing in one ball of wax. We've got an actual knowledge of an unnecessary surgery, and then we have got the fraudulent concealment and misrepresentation.
Would you agree that the court, in reviewing these arguments, have to say, look at each one and decide whether or not those elements are either proven or a fact question raised in the context of a summary judgment, and that we can't just say, well, the whole ball of wax leads us to this conclusion, so we're going to hold this and so.
Yes, sir. And in the Hussein case that we've been talking about, in that case, the plaintiff went to the doctor 3 times. So the court looked at her argument was, look, the doctor failed in her duty to me to have tests run to see if I had breast cancer. That was a failure in the duty that this doctor had to me. And so the court said, well, she went 3 times. On 2 of those occasions, the doctor did order tests, so we have one discrete date that no tests were ordered. In this case, Mr. Ratliff went to see Dr. Earl at least once a month for 2.5 years. And on every one of those dates, said, my back hurts. He said, I'm in pain. He never said, well, the reason you're in pain is because I butchered your back.
All right. Would that then would go to a concealment argument?
It goes to a concealment argument. I think it also goes to a negligent course of treatment. When a doctor fails in his duty as a doctor to that patient, I mean, there is a duty in the state to tell them why they're in pain, and there's a duty to disclose material facts to them that they don't know. He never knew that those test results didn't justify what was done to him. Now, in Dr. Mooney's affidavit states that there was absolutely no objective testing to justify the type of destructive procedure that Dr. Earle performed on Mr. Ratliff's back. And I would suggest that the only way that Dr. Earle could claim that he didn't know that first surgery was unnecessary is for him to admit he was too incompetent to interpret the x-rays, the MRIs, the disc provocation results.
Although, looking at the limitations provision of 4599, would you agree that the purpose of having a three-prong test, you don't get to choose which one you like?
Correct.
That surgery and allegations of negligent surgery are particularly intended or suited for dealing with the date of the breach of the tort. It makes a date ascertainable, which makes limitations law much more predictable for both plaintiffs and defendant doctors.
I agree, and I agree with what you were saying earlier. There are times when the surgery is the only complaint. I mean, we have a lot of cases on file where someone does a surgical procedure on a patient and never sees it again. But when the initial surgery was unnecessary, and that's the very reason that he has to keep coming back month after month to see the doctor, then the harm from that surgery carries over. That surgery was negligent. That surgery was also, at the very least, constructive fraud on the patient. I mean, that's another issue. We've got a fraud claim in this case, but the four-year statute that covers all of this, but
if he had seen another doctor for post-operative care, your claim would be barred.
If he had never gone back to Dr. Earle. Yes, sir. If he had never gone back to Dr. Earle after that, then that would have been the very last day that we could point to. As it was, Dr. Earle continued to treat him. After the second surgery, about 2 weeks later, Mr. Ratliff was unable to write, to walk, to talk, to take care of himself, and never regained that ability. He died in September of 97. And he remained on morphine drips every day for the back pain that he continued to be in. I'd also just like to address the fact that they said that Dr. Earle and Mr. Ratliff's affidavit failed because it was signed by his wife, Shirley, who had the power of attorney. They cite the De Los Santos case, and that is not on point. In that case, there was no evidence that the father couldn't sign his own affidavit, that he was too incapacitated to sign it, as was Mr. Rowland. There's no evidence that the son in that case had the father's power of attorney, as did Shirley Rowland. Also, reading of that case shows that the son forged the father's signature and later admitted that he had done that. To strike Mr. Ratliff's affidavit because he was too incapacitated to sign it himself would be to reward a doctor for rendering his patient so physically incapable of executing an affidavit against the very doctor that committed the malpractice.
Did they maybe strike the affidavit from the trial court?
No.
The trial judge never ruled on the decision.
They moved to strike certain segments of his affidavit that they said were. But no, the trial judge, that this was not raised himself until we were in this court.
If we accept your interpretation on this particular fact, aren't we then introducing a tremendous amount of uncertainty that the legislature intended to put aside by passing the limitations provision of 4599?
Your Honor, I believe that in all of these cases, every single one of them fall on their own facts. I mean, that's what you have to look at. You have to look at the dates of each one. And when you have a surgery that is, by the doctor's actual knowledge, that this is an unnecessary surgery. I mean, in the SIGA case that Dr. Earle signed, there the court said, well, there was no evidence that the doctor knew this was unnecessary. But when you have got a case that facts show that the doctor knew that this was unnecessary and did an extensive destructive surgery on the man, then I think those egregious facts stand on their own. And we have got a continuing course of treatment of his concealment, his misrepresentation, to cover this up.
Then isn't this really a fraudulent concealment case? It's a matter of avoidance of limitations provision?
And we've pled fraudulent concealment.
I know that this case really is about then.
Well, we've got actual knowledge, and we've got a duty, and we've got a fixed purpose to conceal. So, yes, I think we've definitely got a fraudulent concealment claim.
There's fraudulent concealment. Is a defense to limitations, but it could also be action if there's duty to disclose.
Right.
And I'm unclear from your pleadings whether you claim both.
Whether I claim both what?
Both an avoidance or of limitations and a separate cause of action for damages.
Well, I'm claiming that the fraudulent concealment claim deferred limitations and that they didn't commence to run until some later date in there. Now, our later date is December of 1993. Dr. Earle's later date is, well, he saw another doctor in March of 93, so he should have been put on notice then of this fraudulent concealment claim. That still gets us our 2 years. I mean, limitations are deferred, would be deferred even under their argument, to March of 93 and would not commence to run to then. The lawsuit was filed in February of 94. So even under their fraudulent concealment argument, we're within the limitations.
The doctor's counsel indicates that there was no negligence in the second surgical proceeding, or the third and the last one. Do you agree or disagree with that?
I disagree with that. And Dr. Mooney's affidavit clearly states it was breach of the standard of care and that it was medically unwarranted. And the reason it was medically unwarranted, as he states, to reinsert hardware into the back of a patient who's had a 3-level fusion, a 4-level nerve decompression, when that previous hardware failed. He says that is a breach of the standard of care.
The same hardware was reinserted?
Yes, sir. And the doctors that Mr. Ratliff went to earlier, one of them only looked at his neck, because actually, as Dr. Mooney also states, that was his main problem when he went to see Dr. Earle in the first place, was his neck was in far worse shape than his back was. The other doctor agrees that there's tremendous instability and something needs to be done. He never said, we need to go back in and put other screws back in. So Dr. Mooney clearly says that was negligent. You know, had Dr. Earle told Mike Ratliff, I butchered your back, I did a disruptive surgery, shouldn't have done it, that's why you're in the shape you're in, that's why you're never going to get any better, he clearly would have fired his doctor. Clearly would have gotten another doctor, and hopefully a doctor like Dr. Mooney, who would not have put him through the second surgery. And I believe he'd still be alive today if that had happened.
What is my concern about this? It seems to me any surgeon will do some post-operative care, will do some sort of follow-up to see how it's coming along. And the statute is fairly clear that if there's a discernible date there, that's the date that's going to control. It would seem to me all a plaintiff adopting your rule would have to allege is that the doctor committed negligence in the surgery. The doctor knew it was negligence. Obviously, the doctor's supposed to be aware of the standard of care, so the doctor knew he or she made a mistake. And since they didn't reveal that at the post-operative care, therefore, the statute of limitations really doesn't run from the discrete date of the surgery. The statute begins to run from the last date the doctor saw me and looked at my injury. How do you distinguish between the everyday surgery circumstance and the particular circumstance that you say is so compelling here?
Well, I think in the everyday surgery circumstance, hopefully every day we don't have a doctor doing this. But if they have been negligent in that first surgery, and if you have got evidence to show that, then they continue to have that duty to tell their patient. I mean, it's a duty we have as a lawyer to tell our clients.
So your answer is it would apply in every surgical circumstance?
Only in surgical circumstances where the doctor was negligent, and the doctor knew that he was negligent, and he didn't tell the patient. He didn't say, here's the reason why you're having such problems.
What summary judgment evidence is there that he knew he was negligent? Dr. Earle knew he was negligent.
Your Honor, he knew that that first surgery was not necessary.
What summary judgment evidence is?
The summary judgment evidence is his entire medical records, which we submitted, and Dr. Mooney's review of those records. And he says there was absolutely no basis in reading the results of the x-rays, the results of the MRIs, the disc provocation tests. Nothing in those tests, all the objective testing performed, indicated that he needed either a three-level fusion or much less a four-level nerve decompression, because there was no evidence of any nerve root compression. And that was in the radiological test, and that was in Mr. Ratliff's objective complaint. He had never complained of ridiculous pain. So the entire procedure was totally unwarranted. And there's no way that a doctor who can interpret MRIs, x-rays, and other objective tests would not know that, when his decision was totally contrary to the test orders. What we've got here is a doctor who, in the face of all objective testing to the contrary, orders an unnecessary and highly destructive procedure on the back of a 38-year-old laborer just 5 months after his injury, and then conceals that from him. And this court said in the Kimball case that the course of treatment doctrine often applies in cases of misdiagnosis and mistreatment. I think that misdiagnosis is too nice a word for this. I think this is clearly mistreatment. And if this isn't rise to the level of the mistreatment that this court was referring to in the Kimball case, then I don't know if the course of treatment doctrine exists in this state anymore. I hope it does, and I would ask that this court affirm
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
I think Hussein decided the question about whether you call it misdiagnosis, mistreatment. I don't care what you call it. I think the Hussein case is correctly stated. That is immaterial. That is not what you look at. You first look to determine if there, from the facts of each case, is an ascertainable date for which a breach or tort occurred. I would also like to address briefly the argument that there is actual knowledge, there is evidence of actual knowledge in this record that Dr. Earle knew that he had done something wrong and therefore failed to disclose it in the fraudulent concealment aspects of the case. The only evidence is the affidavit of Dr. Mooney, which in it he gives opinions that he wouldn't be, the tests were interpreted one way and should have been interpreted another, and therefore Dr. Earle was wrong in recommending surgery initially. I would direct the court to a case that was not cited in our brief, that is not a medical malpractice case, but was decided by the Supreme Court in 1996, and that is SV versus RV. It does not deal specifically with fraudulent concealment, but it was a directed verdict case, and it does talk about discovery and using that by analogy. That case, by the way, is 933 Southwest 2nd 1. By analogy, I think you're holding at page 15 is particularly instructive. We have held only that the bar of limitations cannot be lowered by no other reason than a swearing match between parties over facts and between experts over opinions. It is quite, and I would submit that's what you have at most here. You have Dr. Mooney saying, I wouldn't have done the surgery because these tests didn't do this or that, whereas Dr. Earle, in his affidavit, denied he was negligent, denied he had actual knowledge of negligence, and denied
that he swearing matches and summary judgment motions between experts in our practice cases.
And all I would do beginning, Your Honor.
Right. Isn't that typically, I mean, is that kind of the way it comes down? When you always have expert testimony in order to keep the case alive, and if you have to see the experts, doesn't that, if issues properly joined, and
right.
I agree, we don't agree with that, but generally, to see the experts in any fact issue in the malpractice case, if the necessary proof requirements are met.
I agree, Your Honor, as to standard of care and as to causation. The issue that I'm arguing this point about is regarding the limitations and the bar of limitations. The argument that had been made to this court a moment ago was that the affidavit of Dr. Mooney stating that the interpretations of the test by Dr. Earl were wrong, therefore he had actual knowledge, or that's the argument, he had actual knowledge.
What about the allegations that Dr. Earl admitted in his deposition that he knew the devices he inserted in the first surgery were temporary, and in fact all the literature relating to the devices indicated that they were temporary, and he never told the patient that he had put in what was a temporary device and was instead telling him everything's going to be okay? That's a pretty specific factual allegation as I read it.
And our brief deals with the issue. There is no summary judgment proof as to the issue that it was temporary versus permanent. Ratliff's affidavit absolutely does not deal with that. In addition, the medical disclosure panel does set forth what requirements were of disclosure. He met those disclosures.
Now, but I understand we're dealing with the question of the failure to disclose on fraudulent concealment limitations, which is what I thought you were talking about.
Okay, I'm sorry. Then, if
the controverting summary judgment evidence shows, in fact, that Dr. Earl admits that he knew the device was temporary.
All right.
And if the summary judgment evidence shows that in fact, he put the device in the patient's back, and if the summary judgment evidence shows that the patient says, I was never told it was temporary, I thought it was permanent, and he kept telling me I was going to get better, why don't we have a fact issue there?
Well, what you would have then, arguably, is fraudulent concealment until the moment that he is put on notice,
okay.
And therefore for further inquiry. When would that be, Your Honor? I would argue it would be the time that within the two-year period, before the second surgery, when he is sent for a second opinion and they are discussing whether or not there should be an additional surgery. At that point, according to Borderline versus Peck, he has knowledge of such facts, is in law equivalent to the cause of action, and therefore is on inquiry. Note that occurred within the two-year period of limitation.
But fraudulent concealment is not, statute of limitations doesn't begin to run. Fraudulent concealment, isn't that correct until the patient is on?
Actually, Your Honor, this court has never addressed that specific point under 4590I.
That's what fraudulent concealment law is generally in Texas.
I would agree that is true. Fraudulent concealment, however, was engrafted into Article 4590I by one opinion that was highly dissented upon. Based upon the fact that 4590I also says, notwithstanding any other law, you have 2 years and 75 days in which to bring a lawsuit. I do not believe this court has specifically addressed how you would interpret fraudulent concealment if the patient is put on notice clearly within your two-year period. If, as you have done in the open courts challenge, if you are put in notice within the two-year period, you must bring your lawsuit within that two-year period. That is still an open question.
Any other questions?
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument in the first call. The court will take a brief recess.
All right.